Hello, this is Carrie Weber, Associate Editor for America Magazine, and I'm here today in the second of our summer podcast series with our Editorial Director, Karen Smith.
Hello.
And a fellow Associate Editor, Father Ed Schmidt.
Hello.
And today we have a variety of topics for you again, and we're going to start with one that Karen brought up, which is about two sisters who were art collectors. Do you want to tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. There's an incredible exhibit at the Jewish Museum here in New York right now called Collecting Matisse and Modern Masters. But the thing that makes it somewhat unique is that it focuses on the two women who actually did the collecting. So the reason people might go is to see this fabulous collection that they have amassed. And this is just 50 of about 3,000 pieces of art that they put together in their lifetimes. But the thing that's interesting, and I thought people might want to think about, is the role of the collector. These two women, their names, their sisters, their true blood sisters, their names are Clarabelle and Etta Cohn, were from a huge family that settled in Baltimore. They were Jewish. And as they grew up, it turns out that they became quite wealthy. Their family was wealthy enough to be able to support the two sisters, and one became a doctor, a pathologist, and her younger sister, that was Clarabelle, her younger sister, Etta, didn't really have a profession as such. She was always kind of helping out around the family. But early on, when she was about 30, and this is right at the turn of the century, she began to collect a couple of works of art. And when the two sisters went abroad and went to Europe, they had been friends with the Stein family. And you probably have heard of Gertrude Stein and Leo Stein and Michael Stein and,
yeah, sure.
And his wife Sally Stein. Anyway, they were friends back in Baltimore. But when they went to Europe, they became caught up in the enthusiasm for these new artists and their work, people that really weren't heard of very much. And when they were, when their works were displayed, people thought pretty badly of them. And they were reviewed with terrible reviews, especially the work of Picasso, who was younger than Matisse, but also Matisse. And it seems funny to think about it now, but these people were producing radical art, art that all the critics tended to despise. And yet these laced-up Victorian women bought.
Right. I mean, you have to imagine the kind of insight they had into either their, I don't know, was it their personal taste or they thought these artists would become famous? What sort of motivated that, do you know?
Well, at the very beginning, Leo and Michael had gotten involved with some of these young artists there in Paris, where they had set up a kind of salon. They'd begun to actually meet them. Leo was interested in painting himself and studied it and tried to become a painter. And, of course, his sister, Gertrude, wanted to become a writer. And so they had these sessions in their home and became quite famous because of them. So some of it was just the kind of clandestine climate of this underworld, the kind of a non-academically okay, something that younger people in their 20s and 30s tend to like to be associated with, really. But then they began to get to know the artists, and Etta Cohn was the same age as Matisse. Not exactly, I mean, there was maybe a year difference, but they lived these long lives together. And by the time they became very old and she had collected, I think 5,000 works, could that be right? No, it must be 500 works by Matisse out of the 3,000 that she's collected altogether. She had amassed the greatest collection of Matisse's work by any person in the world.
Wow. It reminds me a little bit of the Barnes Museum when that they had all of these works of art displayed just in their apartment.
Exactly. Oh, that's a great point. The interesting thing about this, too, is that these sisters picked what they liked and people they liked. And so this lifelong friendship, it became quite a close friendship. Etta Cohn knew the Matisse's wife, his grandson, you know, his whole family. And they were kind of corresponding during the war years, even of World War I, then a little bit during World War II.
What was the value of the collection?
Well, they have estimate that at the time of Etta Cohn's death, she died in 1949, her collection of all 3,000 items was worth about $3 million. But in 2002, and I don't have a more recent estimate than that, it's been valued at around $1 billion. And the thing that makes this especially interesting is not only did they have their apartment crammed full of this stuff And did they live with it and live and love these things? But they knew all along that they were going to give this away to the people. And they gave it to the Baltimore Museum, and they even gave enough money so that the Baltimore Museum could build a wing where all of this would be kept. And of course, it goes on a roadshow like all other museums. And so we get to see it here. And if you don't get to come to New York this summer or you don't live here, there's a fantastic application or app you can put on your iPod or iPad just by going to the Jewish Museum website. You can download this and get the whole story. It's wow. Quite enchanting.
Yeah, that's a modernization of the modern art. We'll move on now to something a little bit perhaps not as monetarily valuable, but spiritual value it offers. St. Augustine's Confessions. Ed, do you want to talk about a new book about the Confessions?
Yes, and actually there is a monetary element here, but we'll get to that in a bit. I recently read an intriguing book, intriguing both in the content and just in the concept of the book. It's called Augustine's Confessions, a Biography. It's the story of a book, the life story of a Christian classic, published by Princeton University Press. It is part of a new book series called Lives of Great Religious Books. The author is Gary Wills, already known for his biography of Augustine and his own translation of Confessions. Titles already published in this series tell the life stories of the Tibetan Book of the Dead and of Dietrich Bonhoeffer's letters and papers from prison. And he gets right to the point in chapter one, he begins to write the biography of Confessions. We have to start in the delivery room. How and when was it born? And then he goes on to describe an ancient author dictating to a bunch of scribes who were expert at taking down the streams of words that came out. There's no author's manuscript, no sitting and musing with a blank page and no keyboard. But the scribes cost money, and writing materials were expensive, all that parchment. A writer as prolific as Augustine was a kind of industry unto himself. And like as a person's biography begins with heritage and birth and then shows development and emphasizes what's important, the biography of a book is doing the same thing. Will says it should describe its internal development, what makes it work, what challenges it meets. But an intriguing insight is that Wills argues that Augustine's Confessions is not to be read as an autobiography. A lot of commentators call it an autobiography. There are folks who say it's the first autobiography. And he does go into some events of his life, his conflicts, his sins, his questions, his doubts. But he leaves out a lot of things that a standard autobiography would get into. So it's not an autobiography, but then what is it? And the answer that Gary Wills would give is the Confessions of Augustine are basically a prayer. The book begins with a very famous invocation, Lord, you are great and greatly to be praised. It starts out as a prayer, and it maintains that second person element all the way through to the end. Later on in the middle of that first chapter, the work comprises 13 books divided into chapters, comes this very famous observation, you made us for yourself, and our human heart is restless until it rests in you. Augustine maintains this atmosphere of wonder and awe throughout the whole book, and skilled author that he is, he comes back to it at the very end, book 13, chapter 38, to say to God, but you, being good and lacking nothing that is good, are always at rest. Restless Augustine has found God who is at rest and who has afforded Augustine at least some measure of that rest.
Now, have you gone back to the Confessions and reread parts of them in the context of looking at it as a prayer?
Oh, definitely. It's a book I go back to a number of times. I've only read through beginning to end once, I think. I know I've only read it through from beginning to end once. But I do go back. There are parts of it that I like very much, and I go back to and reread them. And it throws a different light on it that helps me to see what's really there, and perhaps helps me to understand why I like certain parts so much.
Right. Yeah, it is a book that can be read sort of in segments. You can kind of underline certain parts and go back to them. Have you read much of it, Karen?
I have read a little bit of it, and I like the fact that Augustine uses his own personal experience and reflects on that. And what I find kind of interesting in that is that at one time was always thought to be some very female trait. And I used to love, when I was in divinity school, pointing out that that was the way that Augustine proceeded, actually.
Yeah, it's kind of confessional, which is a popular mode of writing today in a way, without being sort of indulgent.
There's a couple of details that are common that people note in confessions, and one of them is there's an incident in a garden. He's a teenager. He's out with some friends, and they jump over the fence, whatever it is, into a garden and steal pears off a tree. And they take these pears and feed them to some pigs. They didn't want the pears. It was just an act of pure evil. Well, he goes on and on and on for page after page about stealing the pears and what gets into us and why we look for approbation from our friends and the crowd mentality and all this kind of thing. Gary Wills puts that into a very different perspective. Namely, you're in the garden and you've got the tree. This is Adam and Eve in the garden of Eden, where the tree is there and it's got the fruit, and Eve doesn't need the fruit, and Eve picks the fruit and she gives it to Adam, and he wants to go along, and she's his wife, so he takes the fruit from her to go along with her rather than obey the mandate from God, and all of these kind of layers of imagery. And Augustine is saying that all of us have been through this. Not all of us have jumped a fence and stolen fruit from a tree, but we've all confronted the fact that we're capable of sin, and we confront that and we move on because God is greater than the sin that we commit.
Right, yeah. And now, in an attempt at a segue here, I would say that I read that book in college during some homework, and I wonder now, reading the Times today, if I would have been as prepared to do some of that work had I not had some homework in grade school. So that's one of the debates that has come up in a recent New York Times piece. In New Jersey, a school board's going to vote on a proposal to limit weeknight homework to 10 minutes for each year of school. So 20 minutes for second graders, etc. And then there's no homework on weekends or holidays. And there's been a lot of debate about this. And it's not just in New Jersey. It's various places around the country that are trying to limit the amount of homework that kids get in an effort to sort of allow them to be children and allow them to go outside. Whereas other parents and teachers are saying, well, they have to actually learn things. And, you know, this is good practice. So I found this to be a really interesting debate because I don't know. As a kid, I'm sure I would have been on the side of limiting the homework. But now, looking back on the homework that I had to do, I really find it, even if the work itself is not preparing you for, the content of the work is not necessarily memorable, the actual just diligence of doing the work, I find good preparation for actual life. Wherein you're going to go to a job and someone's not going to say, well, as long as you can do it in under 10 minutes, you know, that's fine. I don't know. What was your experience of homework?
Well, I would just say, not answering that question directly yet, but obviously you aren't all that far away from grade school compared to me, but kids today have a lot more to do. I mean, they have to keep their Facebook pages up and they've got to be tweeting all their friends. I mean, they're busy people and we have to respect that, and school shouldn't get in the way of their social life like that.
Of tweeting, no, it's true. 140 characters, that shouldn't even take 10 minutes.
That's right.
That seems, well, but I do think that kids also have maybe more extracurricular pressures in the sense of having to get into the right college. There's more of a structured pressure with sports and with the right clubs and sort of grooming kids from grade school on to the right college. And there's people you can pay thousands of dollars to help you do college applications. But I think that maybe if you just do your homework when you're young, you don't have to necessarily pay somebody when you get older to help you. I don't know. Karen?
I don't really know how excessive homework is these days, but I think there's something to kind of moderation. I think teaching children and teenagers to have some kind of self-discipline and get things done and time themselves, I think the idea of doing what you need to do when you need to do it is an incredibly important skill for later life. Whether you can do it at school or whether you can do it in, I don't know if they have study halls anymore or anything like that, but I was never bothered by homework at all, and so I don't really resonate with it. But in terms of busyness, I had brownies, I took 2 dance classes, I sang, I was in baton twirling, you know, all this other kind of stuff. But one of the big differences was I didn't have any commuting time. I just lived not that far from the school, and there was no pressure on me to go to college at all, and no one in my family had gone. And so that wasn't a consideration. I think for kids today, it's a huge consideration. You pretty much have to, or you're not going to have much of a future. And so I think, but I actually think that this kind of self-discipline and learning to do what you need to is a skill you'll need to succeed in college too, where no one's going to be saying how much homework you can have. So I think there are many more important things for children than how much homework they have. And the biggest one, I think, is how their parents and how their family life is, what their parents value, how they teach their children to have, you know, self-control and enjoy learning and all those kinds of things. And I think that helps a child to shape whatever time they do have, whether it's highly structured or whether it's not.
That makes a lot of sense. One of the quotes in the article was meaningful and manageable. And that seems to be a key to having this homework time be productive, however long it is or whatever day you end up doing it on. And, well, I hope in our next video segments, maybe online, you'll show us some of that baton twirling, Karen.
Oh, but
for now, I want to thank you both for being here with us. And thank you to our listeners. You can log on to our Facebook page and give suggestions for future topics for these podcasts. And we appreciate the input that we've got already. And thanks again for listening.